Hi, I'm DW from Houston.
I'm Kate Urquhart from Minneapolis.
I'm Jamie from New York City.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. When Dan Deacon was 20, he heard a song that changed the way he made music forever.
You know, I'd never heard anything like it before. It'd be like seeing a new color, which I guess is music's like biggest asset, is that you can hear new sounds. I'll probably never see a new color. I'll probably never experience like a new crazy taste, but I'll hear new sounds constantly.
It's Bullseye. This week, Dan Deacon on the song that changed his life. Chris Lilly turns a childhood of dressing up in his mom's clothes into a successful television career. His new show is Angry Boys. And I talk to the actors from the not-boring-at-all costume drama Downton Abbey. Jeez Louise, I love Downton Abbey. Look, it's all the good stuff in popular culture, right here on Bullseye. Let's go! For what's good this week, we go first to our pals at the AV Club in Chicago. We've got Josh Modell and Tasha Robinson here with some picks. Josh, what do you got for us this week?
I've got the DVD release of Steven Soderbergh's latest movie, Contagion. It was kind of pitched to audiences as an outbreak-style thriller, when in fact it's much, much scarier than that. It's a clinical look at what might happen if a terrible disease got loose in the world.
Here's a clip from the movie. It's Kate Winslet and Lawrence Fishburne.
As of last night, there were 5 deaths and 32 cases.
There's a cluster in an elementary school.
Okay, that's the kind of thing you're going to have to be prepared for. It's going to be all over the news big time. What's your single overriding communications objective?
We're isolating the sick and quarantining those that we believe were exposed.
Okay, good. As of this moment, you and I are attached at the cell phone. If you need resources, call me. If you get into a political dogfight, call me. If you find yourself wide awake, staring at the walls at 3 a.m., wondering why you took the job,
this is out right now on DVD and Blu-ray. Soderbergh seems to be really great at making something really interesting out of what would otherwise be a normal genre movie.
Yeah, because I think he basically completely ignores every convention. You know, in this movie, there is no main character. There are, you know, 6 or 7 A-list actors who kind of all have their own stories. Very few of them interact with each other. The only through line is that they're sharing the same experience that the entire world is sharing.
Tasha Robinson, what have you got for us this week?
I've got the latest book by Daniel Handler, who much younger readers will know as Lemony Snicket. But Daniel Handler, in addition to writing the series of Unfortunate Events books, which he's best known for under that name, also writes books for adults. This is called Why We Broke Up, and it is, in fact, a novel about why we broke up.
Myra Kallman does the illustrations in this book. She was on our show one time when she did an illustrated version of The Elements of Style. She does these beautiful watercolors. What's the relationship between the pictures and the words?
Well, the pictures, each chapter begins with a picture of an item, and the story takes the form of a lengthy letter to the person that we broke up with, explaining why we broke up. Each item is part of the story of the relationship, sort of from the beginning to the end.
Is it funny at all?
It's funny in a bitter sort of way. The character whose voice you're hearing is this quirky young girl who is fascinated by old movies and sort of obscure and strange items. And it's very funny to hear her. It's very funny to hear her sort of wry take on how the two of them relate to each other, given that the boyfriend is a jock. It's not a humor book by any means, not in the way his other books kind of tend to be. Well, they all sort of have that sort of bittersweet humor to them, I suppose.
This week's picks from the AV Club. Josh Modell suggests that you check out the movie Contagion, directed by Steven Soderbergh. It's out now on DVD and Blu-ray. And Tasha Robinson suggests the novel Why We Broke Up by Daniel Handler. You can find the AV Club online at avclub.com. Thanks, Josh and Tasha.
Thank you.
Bullseye.
This is Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. So let's start by getting this out of the way. Downton Abbey is an Edwardian costume drama. And it's not just an Edwardian costume drama. It's an Edwardian costume drama
whose central drama revolves around peerage rules. There are a lot of smoldering looks and corsets and gossiping servants, and there's even a dowager countess. And I'm not entirely sure even what a dowager countess is. But whether or not you're the kind of person who has a poster of Mr. Darcy on their wall or a copy of the novelization of Upstairs Downstairs, it's kind of an amazing show. I know that I'm not that guy who loves costume dramas, and I'm basically in love with Downton Abbey. It's a huge hit on ITV in Britain, and the second series premieres this week on Masterpiece on PBS here in the United States. Joining me from WNYC in New York are Hugh Bonneville, who plays the Earl of Grantham, the master of the titular Downton Abbey.
Really, Mama, you know as well as I do that Cora's fortune is not Cora's fortune anymore, thanks to Papa, it is now part of the estate. And the estate is entailed to my heir. That is it. That is all of it.
Dan Stevens, who plays Matthew Crawley, a distant cousin who in Series 1 learned he was the unlikely heir to the estate.
We do not need a butler or a valet if it comes to that. We've always managed perfectly well with a cook and a maid, and they cannot expect us
what
to
they expect,
alter our
Matthew, home. Matthew, is that we won't know how to behave, so if you don't mind, I would rather not confirm their expectations.
I have to be myself, Mother.
And Joanne Froggatt, who plays Anna Smith, the head housemaid, whose romance with the valet, Mr. Bates, set many hearts aflutter in the first series, including, I have to admit, mine.
Will we have to leave Downton?
Not until we want to. I've spoken to his lordship, and he will find a cottage for us near the house.
You told him you want to marry me?
I did.
Before you spoke to me?
You don't mind, do you?
Of course I mind. In fact, I'd give you a smack if I didn't want to kiss you so much. I could burst.
Go! Hugh, Dan, Joanne, welcome to Bullseye.
Hi there. Hi.
Hi.
So I guess I'm going to start with you, Hugh, because I think I can't continue on in this interview without having someone explain this complicated series of machinations that powered the first series of this show. And I kind of feel like since you're the boss on the show, you're the boss of explaining that.
So in a nutshell, the title of the Earl of Grantham goes to the closest living eldest male heir. That heir was killed on the Titanic, and so suddenly the doors are open to find the next male heir, and in fact it turned out to be a third cousin who none of us knew, who was a lawyer in Manchester. So he comes to join the estate, and at the same time there is ructions within the family because my wife Cora, an American, married into the family because she had a lot of cash. And so there's argument about trying to extract the cash from the estate so that this strange third cousin who we've never met doesn't get his hands on it. Unfortunately, that would mean the collapse of the entire estate. So it's a very, very complex situation. But that's where Series 1 ended, with Matthew now being in the bosom of the family. But unfortunately, there are far bigger things to worry about, which is the onset of World War One.
So I have to ask you guys this pretty straight, which is, you know, all of you are veteran actors, and I wonder if when you got a synopsis from your agent, or you got some sides from your agent, or whatever you got, or just a telephone call from your manager, you thought, "Oh, that sounds super boring."
Well, in England, we tend to do things slightly. We're far less paranoid, I think, about allowing actors to see scripts. I know in certain Hollywood projects and so on, you're allowed to see one sentence of what might be your part.
Hugh, I just assumed that you were going to say, "Well, in England, we're much more boring."
Well, we are more boring. Well, that is true. That's a given. But no, we were allowed to read the script. So I'll hand over to the others to just describe what they thought of it.
Yeah, well, when I sat down to read the first episode when it was sent to me before my audition, I think I read like 2 pages or something, and I was hooked. I just was desperate to know what happened to these characters, and I just couldn't put the script down. So I think when you read a script like that, you just know it's great. You know, it's a great story, and that's the basis for any good production, you know, whether it be theatre, film or TV.
Yeah, it was really surprising when it came through. I think we make a lot of costume drama in England. It's one of our biggest exports after, I don't know, tins of tea from Harrods and cushions with the Union Jack on. And so I was really surprised when reading Downton that it was a costume drama with a bit of a modern twist in a way. It's not an adaptation of anything. It's quite refreshing and new. It's got a lot of characters in it. And it's really, really engaging storytelling. And also the character of Matthew appealed to me and got me hooked.
Dan, maybe you can start by telling me a little bit about what it was about the character of Matthew, who is essentially he's an interloper here. He is not part of this cozy world. He's sort of a visitor from modernity, being a city lawyer who only just sort of realizes that he has this connection to the peerage. What was it that appealed to you about that character?
Well, I suppose what appealed was also what made him difficult to play in a way, and what intrigued me was that with everybody else in Downton, you see where they fit into the whole system and what role they play in the estate. And with Matthew, you're not quite sure where he comes from. He is from a different world to them. And so it was up to me to sort of pick my way through the part and learn about, where his place was and what this estate was all about. And Matthew has to sort of learn some lessons, and he passes judgment on a few things, but is sort of taught a lesson at the same time. And so he explores Downton in the way that we do. We come into this world and try and figure it out, and whether we think certain things are right and certain things are wrong.
Hugh, you mentioned that the second series of the show takes place during the beginning of World War I. I think it was a very interesting choice, and I wonder if it was part of the attraction for the three of you. That this is a costume drama, but it is a costume drama that is set just at the very knife's edge. It really is this inflection point, which is very different from something that's set, in 1780 or something like that.
Absolutely. I think that that's a crucial point, and perhaps one of its attractions, why it's worked so well, because it is on the cusp of the modern era. There was a massive shift, obviously, with the First World War, the impact of that, the wiping out of a generation, the rise of the role of women in society, in British society, certainly, that they were having been employed in men's jobs throughout the war because the men were away. Why should they relinquish those jobs, that role in society? And so votes for women were absolutely key before the war, but they absolutely became paramount after it. And the long hot summers of the pre-war era, and that certainty, that confidence that Britain certainly had in itself about its role in the world, the empire, and the structure of a house like Downton, that absolute confidence of everyone knowing their place, that was shattered. And it's the world where the telephone is introduced, where communication and travel are accelerating, and are hints or foreshadowing the world that we live in now in a much more tangible way than perhaps other period dramas are. So there's a sense, I think, that people think they're relaxing into a world of cozy costume drama, but in fact, no one knows what's going to happen next.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guests are members of the cast of Downton Abbey, Hugh Bonneville, Joanne Froggatt, and Dan Stevens. Hugh, I want to ask you a little bit about your character, the Earl, and his relationship to the peerage and the system and this house. His loyalty that you think might be to himself or to his own sort of affluence, or even that of his kids, really seems in season one to be to what at least he sees as a higher ideal, which is the preservation of this, ephemeral thing, this title, and the house, the physical thing, this house and estate that go with it. And I wonder if you can relate to that. To that feeling of loyalty towards something bigger than you, because it's something that seems so admirable. But as I watched it, I wondered if I could.
I don't think it's something that our generation can possibly understand unless we happen to be born into that situation. Having said that, Lord Carnarvon, whose house, Highclere Castle, we film in, is in exactly that situation. His duty since birth has that he will one day take over, as he has done. He was brought up to know that he would take over this estate, and his sole purpose in life is to hand it on to the next generation. I think that's sort of even more true of Robert. I think modern mores and modern sensibilities are different. But to run an estate like that, it's more than just being, you know, counting the cash. It's actually keeping this machine running. And woe betide you if the Chippendale furniture is broken on your watch. It's been there for several hundred years, and it's your duty to hand it on to the next generation. So it's that sense of absolute dogged honour and duty to the name of the family that is paramount for Robert. It's not something I can possibly comprehend coming from the world I do, that we do in the 20th century. But there are, you know, a handful of houses that are still run like that, handed down from generation to generation, to the eldest son, or in these days, eldest daughter. And it's a huge responsibility. I sure as hell wouldn't like to have the heating bills that Lord Carnarvon has to pay for Highclere Castle. and indeed, you know, in the world of Downton, there's a far bigger estate. There's probably up to 200 servants on the estate. And that's not just the gardens and the house. It's actually the village and, you know, the lands around. And it's, you know, if any element of the, of that machinery, the cogs that make Downton Abbey exist, if any of those freeze up or rust in some way, he's got to fix it, else the machine breaks down. So that's why I think in Julian Fellowes's world of Downton Abbey, anyway, there's a sort of benign desire to make sure that everyone's okay, because else his world will collapse.
Joanne, your character on Downton Abbey is like the just the paragon of kindness and virtue. Can you relate to her sort of relative comfort with her place in this system?
Yeah, absolutely. I think obviously for a female in that day and age, life was very, very different than, you know, than the modern woman and how we live now. So but also for a working class girl to be a servant and to be in service was actually, a real asset. And it was a job to be proud of. It was a profession to be proud of. So, and especially for somebody like Anna, who's actually quite young and she's got quite a high place in the house, because she's the head housemaid and she also is lady's maid to the girls as well. So she's done very, very well at her career, and she's very content with that. She is ambitious, but she's a hard worker, and she just knows her world. And things like traveling to different countries and doing, you know, things like that just weren't part of that world. So I think to somebody like Anna, it probably never occurred to her that she's missing anything, because this is all she knows, and actually she's doing very well for herself.
Dan and Hugh, you guys both did a fair amount of comic acting. Dan, you were a member of the Footlights. Hugh, you spent a fair amount of your 30s playing sweet goofuses. I wonder how the sort of gravitas that you have to bring to your role, Hugh, and the maybe dashingness that you have to bring to your role, Dan, weigh upon you how you approach that challenge. Not that it's a big challenge. You're very handsome and gravitas filled men.
Well, thank you. I think, as Joe says, you know, as an actor, you look to mix it up a little bit and look to try different things. I did start out in comedy, I suppose, but actually since I've been working professionally, I've done quite a lot of quite sort of dramatic costume dramas. I haven't had the opportunity that Hugh's had to play the goofuses, which I look forward to fulfilling in my 30s. But, it's been an interesting journey. Certainly in series two, Matthew gets his fair share of grim storyline, so maybe we'll have a few more laughs in the future.
I suppose for my part, I'm very lucky that I've been cast in those roles as you describe. Though that's a word I haven't actually put down on my resume, but I will. There's a series I do at the moment called 2012, which is all about trying to organise the Olympics, which allows me to flex my comedic muscles when I'm not putting on the tweed of Downton Abbey. So I'm very blessed to be able to duck and dive a bit between different genres, but I'm very happy whenever we come back to Downton.
After we come back from a break, I will badger the cast of the very classy costume drama Downton Abbey about their outfits. Plus, Dan Deacon and Chris Lilly. I'm Jesse Thorne, and this is Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International.
Production of Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is supported in part by the menswear blog Put This On, presenting the Put This On Gentlemen's Association. Members receive a handmade pocket handkerchief in the mail every 60 days. More information at putthison.com. And by Ask Metafilter, thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
If you already missed The Sound of Young America, don't worry. In honor of the launch of Bullseye, we've got a free torrent at MaximumFun.org of our entire recorded archive of The Sound of Young America. 15 gigabytes of audio and video, all absolutely free. Hundreds and hundreds of hours of audio infotainment, all free to download and distribute. Find it in your favorite torrent tracker or online at MaximumFun.org. Bullseye's on Twitter. Follow us at twitter.com/bullseye.
Hello there, my name's Graham Clark.
And I'm Dave Shumka.
And together we host a podcast called Stop Podcasting Yourself.
This is a file that you download from the internet and then you listen to it in your pod.
What's that about, you ask? Well, who are you to ask? Who do you think you are?
Yeah, get lost, bozo. We're a couple of stand-up comedians in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and every week we bring a guest on the show. Sometimes they're Canadian, sometimes they're not, sometimes they're a ghost.
It's like you're sitting in on a friendly afternoon chat.
Plus, we're Canadian, so you get a tax break. You can find us on iTunes or online at MaximumFun.org.
Huh? Ooh.
Spell.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guests are members of the cast of Downton Abbey, Hugh Bonneville, Joanne Froggatt, and Dan Stevens. In this clip from the show, Dan's character, Matthew, is in the trenches of World War I, and he gets a note granting him leave to return to Downton Abbey.
When did this arrive? Good news. We've been relieved today by the Devons. The men can finally get some rest. I've got a few days' leave coming to me.
What will you do with them, sir?
London first. Remind myself what real food tastes like. Then north for a couple of days, I suppose. Naturally, there's a girl I want to see while I'm there.
So should hope, sir. Strange, isn't it? Think of our old lives just going on as before. While we're here, in this.
More than strange. I think of my life at Downton. It seems like another world.
Series 2 of the show takes place at the dawn of World War I. And Dan, your character is in service, partly on the front lines, during the series. I wonder how you prepared yourself for a world that is very, very, very different than the, you know, housemaids and whitetails world of the first series.
Yeah, it was a bit of a shock. When we started filming the second series, I was suddenly, yes, not in white tie around a dinner table, but completely covered in mud in a field somewhere in England, carrying a dead guy on my shoulders. So physically, you know, it was very demanding and very different. It was challenging, also a huge amount of fun. There were, you know, real explosions going off all over our head, and that was quite amazing. I suppose it's important to point out that, you know, the show still remains very much about Downton Abbey, and so... Matthew's storyline, as well as being at the front, is really about coming home and what it's like to come home. And I suppose part of the preparation I did was to talk to some soldiers, you know, real-life soldiers, some veterans and some younger modern-day soldiers about who were from a similar sort of class, I guess, and talk to them about what it's like to come back from a war zone and try and
fit in a sort of white tie party situation, which still occasionally happens. I talked to one young soldier who'd been serving in Afghanistan who had to come back and go to a 21st birthday party the following week in white tie at a big country house, and just how mad and strange that was for him. So that, you know, there's a little bit of that that I tried to work in, I suppose. It's a strange thing to get your head around, though.
Can I ask you guys a little bit about outfits?
Yeah.
So I'm kind of an outfit enthusiast, I have to admit. And
what are you wearing?
I am actually. You say that as a joke. We are separated by a few thousand miles and a telephone line right now. But I am actually wearing a pretty serious outfit right now.
Is it a Christmas outfit?
It's a well. Actually, you know, it wouldn't be too far if it were a suit and not an odd jacket. It would be not too far out of line for a hunting trip or a ramble on Downton Abbey.
Nice.
Are you in tweed?
I am not in tweed, but I am wearing a Shetland Fair Isle sweater vest.
Very nice.
And a corduroy sport coat with a throat
latch. Wow, it must be cold over there. Joanne's wearing a bikini and Dan and I are in Bermuda shorts.
they're Downton Abbey official issue Bermuda shorts, I'd like to add.
Joanne, I think I'll start with you. So you're one of many beautiful women on this program.
Oh, thank you.
But several of the other beautiful women on this show get to wear outrageous, complicated dresses.
They get to look slightly more beautiful.
And you get to wear, head made outfits, and I wonder if you ever like check out one of those like crazy dresses and just think like one time maybe we could have it's opposite day at Downton Abbey and the servants are wearing the crazy outfits.
Well, I have suggested to Julian on numerous occasions that he write a scene where Lady Mary and just gives Anna loads of her clothes, so Anna is just trying on all Lady Mary's dresses and things like that. But for some reason he hasn't gone for it yet, and yeah. I don't know why.
Maybe next series.
Hugh and Dan, part of the social protocol of an upper class home in 1915 was this ridiculous series of clothes, to the point where, you know, you have a valet or valet whose job it is to make sure that you're wearing the right clothes at the right time and basically put them on you. And I wonder if there's some relationship between the clothes that you put on and, the choices that you make as an actor or the way that you feel on the set.
I think there definitely is. I think the girls would certainly say that, you know, the corsets make you sit and stand straighter. But Hugh and I are very often in these horribly stiff shirts with very, very stiff collars that sort of cut into your neck. And so you do just naturally find yourself standing a little more upright, a little more correct. And I'm sure that has a bearing on how we act and behave in the show.
And there's a certain amount of uniformity to it. The girls... the girls of the upstairs part of the story probably got changed three or four times a day, mainly because they hadn't got much else to do. and there's a certain uniformity about the dress code for dinner. You know, you will always dress for dinner, and so for the men, that's a question of wearing white tie and tails. But I think I'm gonna let you into a little secret here, a little bit of a season two spoiler. The tuxedo makes an appearance in season two. It's a newfangled invention, which we agree that I will only wear on very, very informal occasions. It's the equivalent of wearing a sort of dressing gown, really, in terms of its informality, and it's of course looked down upon by certain members of the family. But so no, I mean, there's, you know, in the way that just talking about fashion for a moment, obviously the women's, you know, fashion progresses much more visibly, I suppose, from pre-war to through season two to the other side of the war. We finished actually in 1920, beginning of 1920. But the men's progress in fashion is glacially slow.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guests are members of the cast of Downton Abbey: Hugh Bonneville, Joanne Froggatt, and Dan Stevens. There's something interesting that I think you guys touched at a little bit, which is the relationship between the horror of this war that's going on and the rules of the class that are determining all of what happens in these social interactions, and this general sense of reserve where so little can be said explicitly except in secret.
Yeah, I think, well, that's also, you know, often what you're saying in a scene is not what you're actually saying. And as an actor as well, that makes it more interesting to play because, you know, I may be talking to Mr. Bates about polishing buttons, but actually we're kind of saying, I think I'm falling in love with you. So as an actor, that's interesting because you have to find the nuances yourself and find the highs and lows in the scene. And it's fun to do that.
Yeah, this is one of the great things to read as an actor because the definition of subtext isn't there and you have to find it. And we have great fun, as Joe says, you know, especially if you with your opposite number. For me, it's Michelle, it's Lady Mary, but, you know, Brendan or whoever it may be, finding those hidden meanings and storylines and that sort of weave right the way through both series, I think.
As an American, right, so my birthright is to think the peerage system that it's a horrific indignity to freedom or whatever, right? And I get really complicated feelings when in watching the show I find my feelings becoming more complicated than that.
Well, that's good. I think that's the mark of a good engaging story in a way, that it challenges your ideas and of how, you know, you feel things should be. I think, you know, there is still a similar structure in place in society today. It's just that, you know, in place of, you know, your lords and peers or whatever, you have the rich and the wealthy. And, you know, it is possible to become one of those people without, you know, being born into it. And I suppose in an American sense, that is freedom. But the people that end up in those positions hold on to them, I think, in a way that's perhaps not as beneficial to society at large. And I think there is a greater divide now than there perhaps ever was between the haves and the have-nots.
I should explain that I am obscenely rich, like just off the charts rich.
How many servants do you keep on your estate?
Oh, well, I see, that's the thing. I don't call them servants. I just call them service employees. I have one last question for you guys. Joanne, your character, Anna, is engaged in the world's most chaste love affair with a character named Mr. Bates, who is a valet and has a limp and is very honorable. I just have to assume that you're in love with him. I know I'm in love with him. Hugh, Dan, are you guys in love with him?
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
Everyone's in love with him. Everyone's in love with Mr. Bates.
Jeez Louise. I'm straight. I would probably make out with him if it came down to it. Like, as a heterosexual man, I would probably make out with Mr. Bates.
Well, I will let him know.
Okay. Well, Hugh, Dan, Joanne, thank you so much for joining me on Bullseye.
Thanks so much for having us.
It's been a pleasure.
Hugh Bonneville, Dan Stevens, and Joanne Froggatt are three of the many stars of the just great Downton Abbey, the second season of which premieres this week on PBS's Masterpiece. You can watch the first series in full at pbs.org. It's also on DVD and various online streaming services. This is Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Baltimore's Dan Deacon makes and performs music on his computer. It's outrageous, a little bit silly, and it's brought to life by the intense audience participation at his shows. Back when Deacon was 20, he was studying composition in school, and he had a problem. None of his fellow students could perform the complicated pieces he was writing on his computer. But then he was inspired. He heard the compositions of Conlon Nancarro, an American who spent most of his life in Mexico crafting pieces that could only be played by a player piano. Conlon Nancarro's Canon X is the song that changed Dan Deacon's life.
You know, I'd never heard anything like it before. It'd be like seeing a new color, which I guess is music's like biggest asset, is that you can hear new sounds. I'll probably never see a new color. I'll probably never experience like a new crazy taste, but I'll hear new sounds constantly. And Canon X is definitely the song that just like just melted my brain. You know, it's an old player piano, and you can obviously tell a player piano from a real piano because it's very clunky and there's not much dynamic movement, or if any dynamic movement. Thousands of fingers. It's playing at such a rate that you can tell that no human is doing it, but you know it's an acoustic instrument. It's not electronic, but it doesn't sound human. It's mechanical. Most experimental music that I was hearing from that time were like arrhythmic. There was no pulse or rhythm to it. And I really loved rhythm. And, you know, growing up listening to, like, you know, classic rock and pop and stuff, you like that sort of pulse. And while Canon X doesn't have a pulse, it still obviously has, like, a clear rhythm. And I'm into conceptual art and conceptual music, but it's especially rewarding when it sounds awesome as hell. After I heard the piece, I got really inspired by his story. I just kept thinking, like, how did his brain come to make this? How is this sort of like, this is what I made today. Check it out, guys. Want to hear this? Here it is. Canon X. Here you go. He's tired of being frustrated by having to write music that would fit within the confines of a player's abilities. So he wrote almost exclusively for player piano for decades. It sort of justified in my head that I could be making music that, even if it was unplayable, it was still valid to exist. It didn't need to be performed by humans. The music can exist exclusively on the computer as long as I can find a way to present it appropriately. It sounded like something I've always wanted to hear. Like, did you ever see Dune? And where he, like, first sees, like, the Fremen girl from his dream? Like, this song is the Fremen girl from my dream.
Dan Deacon on the song that changed his life, Canon X, composed by Conlon and Caro. Dan Deacon's Twitter handle is at eBay Netflix. We've got Chris Lilly from the new HBO show Angry Boys after a break. I'm Jesse Thorne, and this is Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. You can find our awesome new Bullseye logo on t-shirts in three colors at MaxFunStore.com. Order yours now. That's MaxFunStore.com. You can follow Bullseye on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/Bullseye with Jesse Thorne and click like.
Hi, I'm Justin McElroy.
I'm Travis McElroy.
I'm Griffin McElroy.
We're three brothers. It's not a coincidence. We have a show. It's called My Brother Me. It's an advice show for the modern era. Sometimes we also take questions from the Yahoo Answer Service.
Hey, guys, how many push-ups does it take to look like a werewolf?
That's a fine question, Griffin. We'll answer that one and so much more, including questions from readers about love and navigating the waters of society. Subscribe on iTunes or get it online at MaximumFun.org.
We're brothers.
We're experts.
And we're sorry.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Chris Lilly. He's one of Australia's most popular comedy writers and actors. His new show, Angry Boys, is airing now Sunday nights on HBO. It's a faux documentary looking at a wide breadth of young men in various states of adolescent torment, some of them teenagers, some of them grown adults. Here's a clip from the show.
Come to him a bit more. If you move your head at any time, you're a No, keep your head straight. Ready?
Steve's been such a head lately. Like, he gets pissed off at me no matter what I do.
Daniel, don't spit on your brother.
I'm not spitting on him. It's spit strings. I'm not actually touching him. It's just a game. And sometimes, like, my brothers are in pain. It doesn't mean that they're not enjoying themselves. See, that's what happens because you moved your head, man.
So what you can't see in that clip, because obviously, this is a radio show and you can't see anything, is that Chris is playing a couple of the boys in that scene. And that's always been one of the hallmarks of his work, including Summer Heights High, which ran a couple of years ago on HBO. He's never just a single protagonist. He's always a broad range of characters. I asked Chris Lilly when he got started doing characters. It turns out it was pretty young.
I do remember being, there was an American family that moved in across the road, and I was so excited because America was just this amazing faraway land. And so I met these two young boys. I was like about eight myself and they were about five or something. And I said,
I said to them that I had an American cousin who was staying with us. Then I went back into the house and I dressed up as an American girl with one of my mum's wigs that she had, dressed up in some of my mum's clothes, walked across the road, put on my best American accent, which sounded like some kind of southern sort of, like, I sounded a bit like Tootsie or something, and pretended to be this American cousin to these two kids who completely fell for it. Well, according to my eight-year-old self, they believed that I was this strange woman from across the road. And then I got in trouble for that. My mum got really mad at me.
That sounds like the greatest triumph ever for an eight-year-old. That's like having your own detective agency and solving a crime or something.
Yeah, yeah. I thought I did pretty well. It was one of my best early performances.
You were a stand-up in your 20s. Was your stand-up character-driven?
Well, not at the start. I started doing just as myself because I thought, well, this is what's expected. You're meant to tell stories and do observations. And then I started to realize that I wanted to mix it up a bit. So I brought in, I used to do little songs. So I had a little keyboard on stage and I'd sing songs and I brought in little props. And then I thought of the idea of just talking about a character and then becoming the character on stage.
I want to play a clip from Angry Boys. This is you as this teenager named Nathan, and Nathan lives on a farm in rural Australia with his twin brother and his family. And in this clip, he's essentially describing what he does for fun. And the visual that goes along with this clip is him and his small group of friends going up and down the main street in town, which can be in its entirety contained within one camera shot.
Yeah.
It's like a block, maybe a block and a half. Let's listen to this clip from Angry Boys.
We're the manies. Let's drive up down the main street. Yeah, there's different types of manies. Like, you can do basic manies, which is just driving up and down and checking out what's going on, like calling out to chicks or whatever. Or you can do music manies, you just pump some music and that, just full tunes, blaring and that. Yeah, like back in the day, before I got my license, we did BMX manies. Just cruise up and down, check out what's going on. Walking manies, that's sometimes fun too.
How do you get to know a world like Nathan and his brother's world intimately enough to do this kind of portrayal?
It comes from all different places, like the boys that live on the farm and Daniel and Nathan. I guess I've got two older brothers. We used to spend a lot of time on farms. Like, maybe there's a little bit of that in there. But then once I started writing the characters, I actually went out to country towns in Australia and spent time with teenagers and picked up little things there.
There's this character in the new show Angry Boys called Graham, and I want to play a clip of you as her. And she is a counselor at a juvenile detention facility. And here she is. I mean, sort of her hallmark is her just wild inappropriateness. And in this clip, she introduces the idea of Graham's gotchas. And there's sort of it's a montage of her playing pranks on these 13-year-old kids in jail.
Hey, Trent, we just found out that you're getting an early release. Congratulations. So congratulations. We'll be going home this afternoon. Well done. Let's go pack your bags and get you out of here. Now, where's Mum? Mum should be here somewhere. Trent, I just wanted to say before you go, gotcha.
Trent, mate, yeah, go on.
You got another 9 months in here. We're not letting you out. Marcus has just come back from court. Go easy on him. He's just found out he's going to get the electric chair. Gotcha.
Here's the thing about that, Chris. I mean, I read a bunch of like Australian interviews with you for the show when it came out in Australia a few months ago. And a lot of them focused on the awful things that character says. And she definitely says just wildly awful, inappropriate stuff pretty regularly. But she's a very, I found her to be a very, very sympathetic character.
Yeah, well, that was the idea with her, was to have you think something at the beginning of the first episode and then have your mind completely changed by the end of it. And to have this really nasty, harsh woman who's saying these horrible, racist things and seemingly, yeah, really uncaring towards these boys. And then it slowly, it's revealed as the episode progresses that she actually really cares about these boys. And that language that she's using is to kind of get through to them. Like, she's picked up on that's how they talk to each other. And yeah, and also it's a little bit of a reference to, like, she's a 65-year-old woman. She's sort of from a different generation, and the way she refers to Indigenous people is a little inappropriate.
Are you attracted to kind of the challenge of taking someone being awful and conveying the humanity within that person?
Yeah, well, with that character, that was the goal. But I also play really nasty characters where you don't really feel much compassion at all. Like in Summer Heights High, I played a teenage schoolgirl, Jamae, who is just this nasty.
You mentioned this character, Jamae, from your second show, Summer Heights High, which is on video in the States now. And I want to play a little clip of her. This show is set in what we would call a public high school, and she is like a private school girl who is being introduced to the class. She has just come to this public school as an exchange student, and this is her presenting herself to the audience, her fellow students.
Thank you, Mr. Cameron, for your welcome. And thank you to the traditional landowners of Summer Heights, the Wurundjeri people. My name is Jamae, J-A-M-I-E. Weird name, I know, but you'll get used to it. Yes, I come from one of the most expensive private girls' schools in the state, but I'm actually really cool. Please don't be intimidated by me. People always go, private schools create better citizens, but I would say they create better quality citizens. Studies have shown that students from private schools are more likely to get into uni and end up making a lot more money, while wife beaters and rapists are nearly all public school educated. Sorry, no offense, but it's true.
This character is just super brutal and awful, but I don't know. I still found myself liking her. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's coming from a place of being really naive, like she's had this really privileged life and she doesn't really understand the world, so you kind of forgive her a little bit. And the other thing with Jamae is she's got so much confidence, and she's always talking about how hot she is and how attractive and how everyone wants to be her friend, and she's sort of somehow you kind of believe it and you fall for it. Like, you actually think, oh, she's this really amazing, fun girl, and she's someone that I want to kind of hang out with. It's a strange thing.
It's funny that you can even talk about her in the third person, and the idea of almost falling for her when you are basically talking about you falling for yourself.
Yeah, that's that weird thing. I always do that. Like, when I'm cutting the show together, I always talk about the characters as though they're someone else. I don't even think about it. I just think, yeah, so much work goes into making that. The sort of the world of the characters is that it does feel like it has its own life and it takes off and it is something real.
I'm going to play another clip of this youth counselor character named Graham. This is her in the detention center introducing this thing called the Scaring Young Boys program.
Yeah, well, every couple of months we do our Scaring Young Boys program. I get a young guy in. A boy's been getting in trouble at school. Maybe mum's at their wits' end. They're on a pathway towards criminal activity.
Extra ball and chain for those guys that don't have them. Who needs a ball and chain?
What I like to do is to ham things up a little bit. It's a little role play that we do. We make the prison look a lot scarier and worse than it really is.
Once your ball and chains are on, then get familiar with them, have a walk around, guys.
I have no trouble getting my guys involved. They get a week of privileges if they do so.
Imran, your hats.
A lot of my guys, they're big show-offs.
So they love the opportunity to perform.
Be careful, don't strike each other with your balls, please. Guys, doesn't Taleb look good?
I'm going to use this as an opportunity to get Taleb involved with the other boys.
Very handsome in that outfit. He looks great.
Hello, young man.
Gran and her little dress-up thing. I know that it does look a bit weird on the surface, and at first I was worried that it could have a detrimental effect on the boys.
The kids here call me Psycho Sims. So I hear you've been a naughty boy.
But there's no doubt that it is a tradition, and it does seem to be an effective program.
So most of these people that you're working with in these scenes are like just regular 14, 15-year-old boys who aren't actors at all. And you as the writer, creator, star have to be at least kind of in charge on the set. And I wonder what the relationship was between you as a real person, you as Graham, and these kids who are not really actors and like actually having to control them for show business reasons and also in the scenes. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Well, with that story, the Graham character, there was similarities in the way that I had to control the boys is in the way that Graham had to as well. And We sort of searched all over the place to find them. They were sort of from country towns, and because I wanted to represent the reality of juvenile prisons in Australia, which is there's a lot of Indigenous kids and Pacific Islander kids. So we had to find them from all over the place, and they sort of, a lot of them didn't know each other, but they kind of formed this connection. And there was some really amazing moments where, like within the script, there's a couple of little lines that I need to get, but because it's a fake documentary, we sort of expand on those three lines and it ends up being a whole big scene. And there's a scene where Gran ends up leaving the prison and she has to give a big farewell speech. And it turned out that it was the boys' final scene of the whole shoot, and they'd formed this connection with me and with each other, and I was giving them this big speech, and I expanded on a couple of lines in the script and ended up giving them quite a long, lengthy sort of lecture about the rest of their lives and what they should do. And it had this kind of this reality thing going on. And I could see the boys looking at me, and you'll see it in the show. It's in the episode 11 where they're really listening to what I'm saying. And it's like Gran is actually an important adult figure in their lives for a moment. It's really strange. People were quite emotional during the shooting of that scene, and it was very unusual.
Well, Chris, I sure appreciate you taking the time to be on Bullseye with me. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jesse.
Chris Lilley's hilarious and quite touching new show is called Angry Boys. It's airing now Sunday nights on HBO. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Look, I might live in Los Angeles, but I am a Bay Area kid at heart, born and raised in the Yay. And if you're from the Bay and you're a hip-hop fan, you love E-40, a.k.a. 40 Fontarelli, or Charlie Hustle, 40 Water, the Politician. It comes with the territory. It's like being a middle-aged Jewish guy from Brooklyn that loves Jackie Robinson.
Right quick. Faulty something. Still got it. Double platinum. I'm trying to go double profit. I'm in my own lane. That independent. They back.
E-40 is a great rapper, and that's part of why I picked this song to close out our first show. He's funny, and he's charming, and he has a crazy, distinctive, inventive flow. I love that he makes up great words, too. In this track, at one point, he says that he's feeling gargantic. What I really admire about 40, though, is his ethic. And that's what this song is actually about. I should mention, by the way, that we can't say what this song is called on the radio. We'll just have to settle for To Heck With Them.
A&Rs that think that they rapper. Set tripping ass DJ. Close-minded program director.
The beat on this track is what we in the Bay call a slap. It's a kind of simple drum, bass, clap pattern that shakes your whole car when you turn it up. Between the thumps and the cracks of that simple track, 40 has room for a manifesto. This is a self-made man, the owner of his music, the owner of his record label, the owner of his artistic voice. And I have to be honest, I find it inspirational as heck.
These funny ass acting commercialized rappers be killing me. But they wouldn't have seen on radio, BET, or MTV. Everybody wanna know how I got famous, how I became a celebrity. I did it independently. Didn't nobody sign me. Partner, I signed. Do he feel to be saying, is he really from the game? People love me, man. I'm an icon. It's more than just my flame. People bug me, man, like a python. I squeeze on them, man. When you gonna retire? Probably when I expire. You might not see me on the TV channel, but in the hood, I'm still hot like the left sink handle. Monster like Marlon Brando, keep it lit like a candle. Arsenal know like Rambo, it's mandatory. I told a court. I'm an intelligent heathen. Chico State Police, they banned me for no reason. And oh yeah, just to let you suckers know, I ain't rapping too fast, y'all just listening. This industry ass to
the point is this. This is a guy 20 plus years into the hip hop game, and this song is his statement of purpose. One of the things he says is, yeah, maybe he sold drugs for a while like everybody else in the hood did because he had to, but he got his piece of the pie selling records one at a time out of the back of his car. And he's not afraid to tell you that he thinks he's better at rapping now than he ever was. And if you don't get it, as he puts it, he ain't rapping too fast. Y'all just listening too slow. And if you disagree, well, that's who the chorus is for. That's it for Bullseye this week. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer, Julia Smith. Nick White is our editor. Our intern is Colin Walzak. Special thanks to Roman Mars. Our theme music is Huddle Formation by the Go Team. Thanks to the Go Team and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use that. Thanks to Jason Isaac at WNYC in New York for engineering the East Coast side of our interviews this week. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, on Twitter at Bullseye, or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. And remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off. I'm Jesse Thorne.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
So since this is our first ever show as Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, I just wanted to break in for a second here at the end. We've had an amazing 10 years as the Sound of Young America, starting when I was 19 years old as a college freshman at UC Santa Cruz. And I want to thank every person who's listened to us on the radio and on the internet in all those years, all the folks who've supported us and supported the stations who've carried us. I'm super excited about what I think is going to be a really great new era for us here, and I hope that you're excited too. Listen, if you like Bullseye, keep in touch with us and share us with your friends. We've got a whole podcast network at MaximumFun.org, including forums where you can talk about the show and a group of other great shows. You can catch me on Twitter at Jesse Thorne, and Bullseye is now on Twitter at Bullseye. If you're a Facebook user, you can like us there. We're posting cool stuff on Facebook all the time. Go to Facebook.com/Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. And I am even on Tumblr, if you like the Tumblogs, at jessethorne.tumblr.com. Or you can do it the old-fashioned way, by speaking to them in real life like a human being. Or both. Both works, too. But we can't succeed without you, so thank you for all of your support, and thank you for sharing Bullseye with everybody out there who might like it. We'll talk to you next week, and hopefully for years to come, on Bullseye.
PRI. Public Radio International.